So I had a few things that I would like to share, maybe just to start off a conversation, but we can certainly adapt to what's interesting to us right here. We'll just see how that goes, if that's all right. We are now starting with a mic. And I am Frank Rogers, and this is a session on practicing our faith justly within a world of child abuse. And the theme that I'd like to play around with and open up for our reflection is we've been looking at, throughout the various programs of this summer, what does it mean to practice our faith? And what does it mean to walk in the ways of God and to give glory to God in the ways in which we live, in the ways in which we die? What are the different practices of forgiveness and honoring our body and praying and worshiping and keeping Sabbath and the various things that make up a way of being, a way of life that God is inviting us to participate in? And what I would like to do is open us for our reflection today, reflecting on what does it mean to be practicing our faith in these various arenas within a very particular context, and that is standing in the world of the reality that there is child abuse in our world, and to raise the question, what does it mean to practice our faith in a world of child abuse? And as we do that, to try to really step into that world a little bit and look at what would it mean to think about these very issues. What does it mean to honor our bodies? What does it mean to live and die well? What does it mean to forgive in the context of someone who is abused or is being abused or has been or knows people? And I think it puts a different shade on the way in which we think about the practices that make up our faith. And so that's what I would like to just orient us to, some of those concerns and issues, and see where that takes us, if that's okay. Is that what you're going to get into? And I'd like to start out, read a very short piece of scripture, and then I'd like to tell a story that kind of sets a context, and then I'd like for us to spend a few moments in a prayerful space, and then reflect together out of that space. And I think this might be a faithful way of even engaging this issue, that part of reflecting upon the reality of child abuse is to let the voices of these persons speak and to hear their world and to try to have some empathic solidarity with their own very painful, sometimes, life. So the verse is just one verse, Psalm 50, verse 3. Our God is coming, and God will not be silent. A fire devours before God, and around God a tempest rages. I first met Stuart actually in a context very much like the one that we are in now. This was in the early 1980s, and I was a camp counselor at a Christian camp in Cape Cod. And it was the second day of camp, and it was one of these glorious days where the sky is absolutely bright blue and puffy white clouds are just easing their way across the horizon. And Stuart was walking on a path. And he had his hands in his pockets, and he was just kind of sauntering along, and he was whistling, having just enjoying this beautiful day, which would not have been at all unusual, except for the fact that behind him, about 200 yards, the campground was burning down. And there was smoke billowing out of this field, and I, along with every other camper and counselor in that place, were running as fast as we could to go and get buckets and get water out of the lake and put this fire out before it devoured this old tool shed that it was too close to. And I'm running by this guy I hadn't even met yet, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Oh, I'm taking a walk." I said, "Taking a walk? The campground's burning down." And he says, "Oh, I know all about fire." And not realizing how prophetic those words were, I just ran right on by him and joined everybody else, and we put the fire out, and fortunately no buildings were damaged. But after that, we realized we had a problem. Somebody had started this fire. And the counselors got together and we did a cabin check, and sure enough, we found under this one boy's cabin, under his bed, in his little suitcase, was four big boxes of booked matches. Boxes full of, 100 match boxes, and it belonged to Stuart Brooks. And then I remembered this rather anomalous behavior at the site of this fire, and we decided we needed to have a talk with Stuart. Well, we invited him in to this counselor's meeting, and he came in all Wolverine. I mean, he had a bravado and a defiance about him, like he was cornered and he was ready to come out fighting. But inside, he was all puppy dog. And before long, he was admitting that, yes, he put this fire, and he was just trying to make a little fire out there and see if he could still put it out. Please don't make him go back home. He wants to hang out here, and he promises he won't ever do it again. And before long, we're saying, okay, Stuart, it's okay. You can stay here, but we certainly are going to take all the matches from you, right? Well, I was asked to take a particular interest in Stuart, and even asked to have him become my CIT, the counselor in training. I was a camp counselor of a little cabin with 6 7-year-old boys. And so I went out looking for Stuart the next day, and I found him up in the senior high area, in the smoking area. And he was involved in this incredible challenge game with the other senior high kids, where they would each get a match, and they would strike it at the same time. And then they would watch as the flame just kind of slithered down the match until it became so hot on their fingers that they would have to let it go. And they would see who was the person who could hold on to that match the longest. And Stuart would go into this zone. And he would just watch as that flame would come down, and long after everybody else has had to already flick that match away, he would just look at that flame as it would just go into the crease between his fingers, and the flame would put itself out. He never lost that game. Well, with some fear and trepidation, I asked Stuart if he would like to be my counselor in training for the summer. And he wasn't sure about what to do and about that, and sized me up a bit, but he agreed, okay, he would show up the next day. And he came to our room where we were in a craft room, and we were doing this craft with these 7-year-olds. And he came in with his jean jacket. It was kind of the collar was up, James Dean style. And he was a little bit cool for what we were doing, and just kind of watched and hung out around the sides. But at one point in the middle of it, both I and the craft director were too involved to be able to help this third boy who was struggling. I said, Stuart, would you mind showing this guy how to get his scissors around the piece of paper? And before you knew it, Stuart was inside this craft activity, cutting out this incredible mask that had this gruesome face, much to everybody's delight, and Stuart became an instant hit with these boys. And from that point on, Stuart became an inseparable part of our gang. For that entire summer, he followed us around everywhere. He was like my right-hand man. I mean, he was an absolute great assistant. And I watched him as he began to lead these kids and become their adored big brother. He would coordinate cannonball contests off the dock, and one day he was showing them how to shoot archery with all of the confidence as if he was Robin Hood. And I knew darn well that he knew nothing about archery, but you wouldn't know it by the way he was telling them how to hold their bow. And one night he led a commando squad on the kitchen, invading the refrigerator complete with camouflage and night vision binoculars made out of sticks tied together with string. I mean, the kids absolutely loved this guy. And as he was spending time with us, I watched as his bravado began to mellow a little bit. And that cool hand Luke smile kind of flashed around his face a little more freely. And I also watched as the calluses on his fingers began to heal and he spent less time up with these smoking kids. I also watched him scare the liver out of these boys. We were out on an overnight. Our camp was on this lake, and on the far side of the lake was this big beach. And we went over there, a big long hike, to have this overnight. And the kids were absolutely looking forward to it. We had a big campfire, and around it we told ghost stories. And that night, Stuart told a ghost story about this boy who had been murdered by his father, but his spirit haunted the woods all around us. And his spirit would light fires, blazing infernos that would devour anything that happened to be wandering in the woods in those nights. The kids were terrified. I was more terrified. Because I began looking for our matches and making sure I had them tucked under my pillow. But that was also the night, after all the kids were put into bed, that Stuart told me a little bit about his own life. His father was a very prominent minister in a posh suburb outside of Boston. And his father had a problem. And he thought that his son had a defiant spirit that needed to be beaten out of. And although on the outside you would see this person as a very successful and good-natured kind of pastor, on the inside, when he came home, he would beat Stuart. Sometimes he would lock him in closets overnight. Sometimes he would make Stuart strip, and he would take a towel and he would wind it all up and he would just snap Stuart, leaving welts on his body. And as I listened to all of this, part of the story of the rage made sense to me. But I would say, Stuart, why don't you tell somebody about this? I mean, this is horrible. He says, are you kidding? He said, I tried that once. I told my coach about what was happening. He said, are you kidding me? Man, you've got a great family. You should be grateful. And they called this big meeting, and they came to our house, and the school counselor, and they all talked about it. My dad said they didn't know what was wrong with me and why I would make up these stories. And that night after they left, my dad gave me a beating like you cannot imagine. You've never seen my dad get mad. And he told me if I ever told another person in my life, I would be murdered by him. I'm telling you, I'm not going there anymore. And the hell of this boy's life became very real to me. I only saw Stuart almost cry once. It's the last day of camp. His dad was late picking him up, and all the other kids were already picked up and had left. And I was in our cabin and folding sheets and putting bunks away. And Stuart was giving me a hand when out through the window, we saw his dad's brand new car drive up. And he flashed a look outside, and he looked back at me and he said, hey, Frank, I got a great idea. You're going to Princeton. You're going to study seminary. Why don't I come with you? You can adopt me. I'll be living in your dorm room. It'll be great. I'll go to school down there. Won't it be cool? What do you think? Isn't it great? And I said something really stupid like, hey, Stuart, it's all right. We're friends for life, right? High fives, man. No big deal. And he choked back this tear as he started to say, yeah, friends for life, yeah. And he sucked it back up, and he walked out the cabin. And by the time he made it to his dad's car, he was all Wolverine again. Defiant, getting into the back seat of that car without as much as a nod to his dad. And I watched him drive away. Well, it must have been 6 years later. I was finished with my seminary work and in the midst of my PhD program, working on my dissertation one night, when I got a phone call out of the blue, and it was the son of the director of the camp. I hadn't seen him in 6 years. And he was a business person, happened to be in Princeton, and was driving through town and said, hey, why don't we get together for dinner? And so we did. We went to a restaurant. We began playing that game about, hey, whatever happened to so-and-so? And remember so-and-so? And whatever happened to him? And someplace through the course of that conversation, I said, hey, do you remember that boy, Stuart? Whatever happened to Stuart? And his face, it just went white. He said, you don't know? And I said, no, what? He said, well, geez, this was several years ago. Stuart was a senior in high school. It was springtime. And you know how he and his old man, they never got along. I thought he was just going to graduate and get the hell out of that house. But sometime in April, he got into his dad's brand new Mercedes-Benz car, and he drove down to the Cape. And you remember that beach over on the far side? He drove the car over there. And he brought with him a whole lot of gasoline. And he doused the entire inside of that car. And he lit his last match. Our God is coming, and God will not be silent. A devouring fire comes before God, and around God, a raging tempest swirls. I'd like for us to just take a moment and allow the spirit of Stuart to be within our midst, but also we all know children who have known abuse and pain, neglect, children whose voices do not always have the power to be heard. May the fires which dwell in the souls of these children and all the children who know pain, may these fires truly be places where God weds God's spirit with this world. Amen. Well, we live in a world where children are abused. There's a statement that was made by Rabbi Irving Greenberg that I kind of consider as an epigram whenever I reflect on this. It's a Jewish rabbi who was reflecting on the fact that during the Holocaust, 1.5 million of the Jews that were killed were children. And he made a statement that said, "No statement, theological or otherwise, should ever be uttered that is not credible in the sight of burning children." Which gives us a rather severe litmus test for the way in which we think about our practicing of our faith. Does our reflection, does our words, do our practices, are they credible in the midst of the reality that there are burning children in our world? For the 1998 was the second year where there has been a surpassing of the 3 million mark for the number of children reported to CPS services throughout the country. Children who have been neglected or abused. 3 million a year. It's twice the number of the children that were killed in the Holocaust. And those are only the numbers that are reported. Stuart would not have been one of those numbers. And there are untold millions of kids who endure various types of abuse that do not get reported. Statistics suggest that 1 out of 3 women has suffered some form of sexual abuse before they are 18. 1 out of 7 boys suffer sexual abuse. So numbers are staggering, but the numbers are pale compared to the reality of just one story, one person who knows that kind of pain. And so the question that I put for us is, as we empathize with these children, as we seek to step into the world of their pain, of their yearnings, of their turmoils, their rages, what does it mean for us as a church to practice our faith? What kind of faith is credible in the midst of this reality and pain that swirls around our world? Question become a real one? Well, and I don't have a lot of answers, but I have a lot of questions. And I thought maybe I would just identify some of the questions that emerge when we wrestle with this as a community of faith. Some of the painful, complicated, complex issues that do not have easy answers. And let me just name four challenges that emerge as we practice our faith. And I'm going to use the practices that are in this book, four of them, to suggest some different things. One of the practices that is suggested is the honoring of our bodies. That one of the things that we as Christians are invited to do is recognize that our bodies are sacraments, places in which God's Spirit dwells, that we are bodied creatures, and that God's glory is manifest in the world through the ways in which we are in our bodies. What does it mean to honor our body in the midst of the reality of abuse in our world? And several things come to mind. One thing that we need to be very cognizant of is that children who've been abused and become adults have a very difficult time with their bodies. They don't feel at home in their bodies. They feel like their bodies have betrayed them. They're very resistant to being touched, being approached. They sense danger. It is not a comforting kind of thing. How do we practice as a community the honoring of our bodies in a way that does justice and recognizes the painful ways in which children who have survived abuse are in their bodies? One example is many churches in Passing the Peace, it's common just to give everybody a big hug. And many, many people find that to be a great source of connection. And it's very important, and it should not be diminished. I know many, many survivors of abuse who are so frightened during that time of church. They feel that and experience that as a very severe threat. How do we practice honoring our body in a way that is sensitive to children of abuse? Does that make sense as a question? Another issue that comes up in terms of abuse and honoring the body, for parents, how do we discipline our children in ways that honor the body? Corporal punishment is a phenomenon that most of us have endured and lived through. It is, in the United States, still a legal thing for parents to do. Not all countries is it legal. Switzerland, it is illegal to spank your child. In the United States, it still is legal. But if you slapped your child on the wrist, is that considered an act of abuse in the United States? It is.
It is.
It is.
Slap your child on the wrist?
Slapping a child on the wrist is an act of abuse.
But not spanking them.
Spanking is okay. That's right. You may slap a child on the buttocks. Is the only way in which, in the United States, it is legal to strike a child. If you had a ring on your finger and you gave your child a swat on the butt and left a bruise, that would be considered an act of child abuse, legally. It's never prosecuted, but by definition, that is what is considered. But any other form of striking a child is considered child abuse. But that's really a secondary question. The primary question is, what does it mean as Christians, as parents, what does it mean to honor the body of a child as we seek to discipline them? And one of the things that I think the church really needs to wrestle with is corporal punishment. Is spanking of any form a way of honoring the body? Or are there other ways of bringing guidance to our children that give them dignity bring honor to their bodies as well? It's an issue that we as a church, community of faith, need to wrestle with very, very severely in light of the reality of abuse. One of the many studies have been done on what are some of the contributing causes of child abuse in families in which abuse occurs. What are some of the common characteristics? And one of the common characteristics is a place in which striking is an accepted pattern within that family. And one of the scenarios that often happens is, you know, parent gets frustrated, is stressed out at their limits, and a spanking becomes something more severe than it perhaps was intended to be. That's a very common way in which abuse, physical abuse, happens. So, but that's a question that the church needs to wrestle with.
Well, when my dad got the belt, mm-hmm. and I got the hairbrush, mm-hmm. but it was interesting, he was on the railroad, mm-hmm. and many times if I was to be punished, he would be on a run, and I would have to stay in my room mm-hmm. yeah. until he came,
right,
and to administer the punishment.
Yeah.
And the act of thinking about the punishment was much worse mm-hmm. than the act itself. The act itself, fine, it's over.
Right.
But in punishing, if at least in my view, if a child has time to reflect on why the punishment is given, the punishment doesn't have to be very severe, because the thinking of it is about it can be profound for a child or an adult for that matter.
Yeah, and I think that is an important clue, that whatever punishment or, you know, that we are providing, that it should be educational. I mean, whatever, when a child is doing something, we ought to intervene in a way that the child is learning that what they're doing is wrong and why what they're doing is wrong. You know, some child advocates call that natural and logical consequences. If you do not eat your meal at the dinner table, then what would be a logical consequence? You get spanked. Would not necessarily be logical. You do not get to eat dessert until you finish a meal. It would be a logical consequence of that, and there would be a reason for that. I mean, you need to have nutrition in your body before you have the sweets in your body, and so that would make a lot of sense. Turning whatever the situation is into something which a child can learn. But the other side to that, I would say, is learning in the context of appreciation and dignity is very different than reflecting on it in the context of fear. And how do I avoid the wrath of my dad's belt is not the most safe context in which to really reflect upon what it was that I had been doing. But my own hunch is that spanking teaches you not what right behavior is. It teaches you how to avoid the wrath of a particular parent and to escape that. But it does not necessarily connect with what the grievance was or whatever. But it's very...
Well, one has a tendency to administer what they've had.
That's right. Well, sure, we all
do. Ideas.
Absolutely.
It turns out all that stuff is right. You have a tendency to administer corporal punishment when it's in the least interest of the child and mm-hmm. the best interest of you.
Right.
And I went to a parenting sessions, and it turns out you can figure out when your personality is most vulnerable and get the clues mm-hmm. in your personality that's going to you're now at the 90% level. Be careful.
Right. Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I haven't struck either boy in years.
Yeah.
And it was just out of frustration when they wouldn't do things.
Right.
But you can recognize, and I don't think, you know, my children are abused. It's more the reverse, the parents are. But corporal punishment can be pretty dramatic. So
yeah.
Anyway, there are these signs, at
right.
least in my life, that I can recognize.
Well, I think that's very insightful. Corporal punishment tends to follow that pattern, that it's not, it's never consistent. You know, it's not the same act that a child does always leads to a spanking. And so you begin to make the connection in a Skinnerian behaviorism mm-hmm. that when you do this, it leads to a bad result. I mean, you could do the same thing and a parent will let it roll off of them, or they'll just give you a stern warning, or they might give you an empty threat. You're going to go to your room. But you know, if they're in a decent mood, that's, you know how to gauge all that. But then you get the spanking when the parent's at their stressed out point and they've reached their limit. And so what the child is learning is not right and wrong behavior. The child is learning how to read a parent's stress level and gauge that. That's what a child's learning. And so it loses its connection to what it's all about. As well as learning that violence is an appropriate way to resolve conflict and to fear your parent and that disruption of the trust in your parent and all of that. And the other thing, though, I think that in terms of the church practicing our faith in the midst of this reality that you alluded to is that you took a parenting class someplace along the line. This is one of my big pet peeves. You know, a child cannot go into a car until they've taken driver's ed, they've had a permit, they've passed tests. But we can have children and never have any kind of class or any opportunity to reflect on what does it mean to parent. And so we do exactly, all of us rely on how was I parented, you know, and what did my parents do? Unconsciously we do that. We usually don't even think about it. We just sort of slip into it. One of the huge things that the church can do that I think parents would cry out for as well is to offer parenting classes, opportunities to reflect on what does it mean to parent your child. Make it part of the baptism. If you have infant baptism in your congregation, and the part of baptismal training is reflecting on what is it going to mean to parent this child in the faith. And that doesn't just mean having prayers with your children at night, as important and as that is, but it also is in terms of the other parts of your life, disciplining and what do you do when you're stressed out, and you know, et cetera.
Well, you know, doctors practice medicine, but not without 6-8 years of training to do that. And if you're talking about practicing our faith in the same context, then it takes an entirely different meaning. How well have I been trained up in my faith if I'm going to practice that? Mm-hmm. And it turns out very poorly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's perhaps one of the jobs of the church and the church community is to provide that kind of training mm-hmm. where an active faith is de rigueur instead of the exception.
That's right. Yeah, but the church to provide opportunities for us to reflect on and practice what does it mean for us to be faithful? Yeah, to have education around that, to make it, you know, there was an allusion to the way that the early church was catechized into the church. And you did not just join, you know, come up on Sunday. You had to go through a severe 3-year process before you were welcomed into the community and could be baptized. I mean, talk about training. You know, what does it mean to be faithful, and what are those practices? That was very serious, very serious attention to that.
But it seems to me too that one of the gauges that we have in the past had for who was faithful, especially if you were a parent, is that your children were good, and so you had this standard that you thought you had to meet, that your children had to be perfect out in public, and that lends itself to child abuse. Oh, so the church is fostering this.
Boy, isn't that the truth? That, I think, is such an insightful point. That the church gives this expectation of what? Children should be quiet and sit in their place in worship service.
Even our little grandson, who is, I suppose, not a particularly good example of how a little boy should be out in the Vespers the night before last, there were a great many people who were very upset with him and with his parents for allowing him to kind of be free and open. And it was an interesting experience for me because I thought that, you know, for them to restrain him maybe was good, I don't know, but that's what was expected.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you got that feedback, because I didn't have any negative reaction to that, but I didn't go up and tell tell them, oh, that was cute. You know, so you
well, last night, when
that's what I thought that it was okay, because he wasn't loud. He wasn't disruptive.
Last night when they went back to the second Vespers, it was very obvious that a great many people were very upset.
Oh.
And Kirk said, our son, who we have not been able to get into a church for years, said, I will not go back to Vespers again.
Yeah.
So, you know, well, this is the kind of thing that...
So the people that didn't object to that, because, I mean, he wasn't doing anything, he wasn't loud, he wasn't disruptive, I didn't think. So, but I
he was totally fascinated, and I mm-hmm. thought it was...
Kind of the sins of omission and the sins of commission.
I
noticed it, and it didn't bother me. I mean, in fact, I quite the opposite. I was so glad for that and that there was not that pressure. But I did not go up to the parents and ease their concern about that and say, hey, you know, we as a community, or at least my part of it, is, you know, really embraces that and celebrates that. So in both ways, I mean, we participate in that. I think that's a tremendous, tremendously good example. I mean, as a parent, I feel that too, being in situations and wondering, what are the expectations here? And it'd be very easy for me then to want Justin to fit that mold, and I get frustrated if he's not, and that's all about me and my need to be accepted by this community. It's not Justin's need. But it could very easily slip over to Justin getting reprimanded or, you know, whatever.
He's bad
because he's not fitting in. And what are the expectations of an 8-year-old active boy in the midst of a Vespers service? I mean, you know, and whose Vespers service is it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it his Vespers service as much as it is our Vespers service? I mean, this is exactly the thing that we as a community need to reflect upon. Are the children ours as well? Or are they the marginalized ones, the forgotten ones?
And one person said to me, well, you know, it's impossible to worship in a situation like that when that child was acting like that. And I thought, here's an opportunity to embrace a young family who doesn't go to church. But your own ability to worship is more important.
And what is worship? What does it mean to worship? Is worshiping only, I'm assuming, you know, that contemplative quiet and being able to be silent, or is worshiping also giving hospitality to all persons and allowing them to be, is that not worship? Are we not able to worship better because of that person being in our midst? We need to reflect on exactly that practice.
In one church that we went to, we didn't have compulsion to put our kids in the nursery. The pastor said that a vibrant church community is replete with the sounds of the young.
Right.
And you know, the sermon would be continually interrupted by some noise from a child, but to him it was the noise of a growing congregation.
The noise of life.
And that attitude was, you know, leadership is I mean, that's what being a leader is setting the example.
I think that's exactly right.
And you know, I think in this case, you know, a growing community and things would have been, I'll certainly say something, you know, because it doesn't really bother me much. It's part of a growing, it's the new generation of Christians.
Absolutely.
Where would our church be if the kids weren't there?
Yeah,
absolutely. And so to teach them subliminally that they're really not welcome unless they do it our way.
Unless they're perfect little people.
Yes.
Depending on what you call perfect.
Yeah, by our definition of what perfect is, you know, maybe that boy was being the perfect boy at that point and
he
just wandering
dancing,
around. Oh,
music,
gosh, yes.
He was great.
Absolutely.
His body and everything, looking. He was very attentive.
He was very fascinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was his aunt.
Yes, Aunt Betsy.
And even children who aren't attentive, I mean, you know, who are rustling and, you know, flipping through pages or, you know, whatever, they are participating also. I mean, they are, I mean, even if they weren't, I think we need to welcome them. But I'm amazed at Justin, you know, who has a hard time sitting still after, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. But he, you know, later on, he'll ask a question, you know, 2 hours later about something, or in the middle of a song, he'll say, "Oh, but that's not right," you know, about, you know, whatever. I mean, or make some implication. It's connecting at some, in some level, and, you know, in his own way. I mean, he's an 8-year-old.
And you think of the movie of the, you know, the Puritan, where the, you know, the kid twitches a little bit and there's something that goes out like that and flattens him against the back of the pew, you know, because he twitched. Mm-hmm. And and as opposed to somebody who enjoys being in church and they're absorbing it, whether we think they are or not, regardless of the overt activity.
Right.
I was sitting behind a family one time, the older sister, she was about 17, the little sister. Finally, I
passed. Which one was more distracting?
That's right. That's right.
I passed this note of a sister, and I had said, "You don't have to sit still to go to heaven."
Oh gosh.
Oh dear.
Well, I think one thing that I guess I've been very lucky that I've had the opportunity to attend some parenting classes, if you will, before I needed to, kind of thing. And one thing that sticks in my mind is that the child will always remember the punishment, but will rarely remember what they were punished for.
Yeah.
So, or, you know, the act of hitting, basically they remember the act of hitting. But
I can still feel it. I mean, my mom used one of those wooden spoons or those paddles that you, you know, I mean, I can feel it, you know, just, you know, just, it just brings that shiver back. I remember episodes and episodes. I could not tell you one time what it was that, you know, that actually happened, but I remember that.
I was spanked once in my entire childhood, and that was for saying, "I wish I were dead." My mother said, "Don't you ever say that again." And she spanked me, but my mother was an abused child. She was beaten and beaten and beaten and beaten, and she changed the pattern. She never abused us.
That's a very difficult.
Yes.
That is, to say it stops now. It stops now. Yeah.
She got married as an oldest. She wasn't married until she was 35, and so she was able to became a Christian in that process. But it was quite remarkable.
Right.
I think we've been kind of almost drummed into when in Rome, do as the Romans do. And that's become kind of a motto. You say, well, it's easier to fit in than make waves. Making waves would be going contrary to this thing where everybody's quiet and perfect and everything, you know, and understanding that there's worship going on in many different forms.
Yeah.
I remember one lady told the pastor that she was really upset. She said, "Pastor, the children are chewing gum in the sanctuary." And he said, "Well, simply, madam," he said, "the children are the sanctuary." And the discussion was over. I thought, what a wonderful response.
Well, right, and that comes back to the notion of leadership too. And I think leadership does make a huge difference. To have a pastor announce that this is our policy, or to, you know, from the pulpit preach about it every once in a while, or whatever, that does set a tone. You know, to have a pastor say, you know, at the Vespers service, you know, "We are delighted at the life that is here," you know, and I don't know these pastors well, but I'm sure that that's what they were thinking, you know. Absolutely. But that itself would then, you know, ease the discomfort of the parents who are worried, and you know, helps everybody else just kind of roll with it all. But that kind of thing does make a big difference. It's a big difference. Also, I mean, but it's a real pressure. I mean, Justin and I went to Korea last March, and you know, and in Korea, you know, Justin was just interested in everything. And he, you know, we would go to these fancy dinners in these restaurants where you sit on the floor and, you know, people come in with all these different meals. And he wants to go look at the fish in the pond out there and just, you know, all over the place. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, feeling this, you know, what are these people thinking? We're in a different culture. We're being, you know, entertained and all of this. And yet, you know, Justin, you know, he doesn't, you know, need to have to live into expectations that are not his and needs to be able to be, this is his trip too. And, you know, I remember feeling, you know, I would get stressed about this very thing. And, you know, parents do in so many situations. Another thing I think the church is invited to do is to have opportunities for parents to support one another and talk about these kinds of things. But it, you know, just goes a long, long, long way.
It's usually the case, like at a soccer game or a t-ball game or whatever, the kids are having fun. It's the parents that are uptight.
That's right. Who's way
out of their level.
Right, right.
Or go up to their level, it might be.
Thank you.
Well, and there's an underlying theme in a lot of these comments, and that is how much of parenting is about the parent meeting their own needs through the child.
Right.
As opposed to being attentive to what are the needs of that child and, you know, what's appropriate to a particular age? What is the life that is aching to bubble out of them? How do we nurture that instead of, you know, dumping our baggage out on them or working through our unresolved issues through them, putting them through expectations we're not comfortable with. The parts of us that we are, you know, when you said, mentioned your mother, I mean, I couldn't help having been abused also. You know, that one part about wishing you were dead, you know, is something that's very hard to embrace. And to see your child say, I wish you were dead, I mean, if Justin did that, my reaction to that would less have been, you know, we all have feelings like that. You know, sometimes you just wish, you know, life is so painful, you wish you were dead and empathize with that. Instead, you know, my own inability to embrace those feelings in me would say, don't ever say that again and try to, you know, beat it out of him.
That was the
but
only
it's really
time
beat
she
out
ever
of,
lost
you know,
it. That's the only
yeah,
time.
Right.
So,
right.
So. I think maybe she had known someone who had committed suicide.
Right.
Close to her, and it was a very disturbing thing to, for someone to say.
Right. That's, I think, what I, you know, that it tapped into something in her that really.
Well, maybe she felt like it many times.
Yeah.
Yes.
And had a hard time accepting that. And, you know, which is another thing that I wanted to bring about abused, practicing our faith in the midst of abuse, is that abused, people who've known abuse, have a lot of emotions that often are discouraged in Christian contexts. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, the feeling of despair. The feeling of, you know, suicide, wishing that you were dead, you are worthless, damaged goods, don't fit in.
We should be teaching that to children, too, because a great many children, when they're in their early teens, are suicidal.
Exactly.
And we can somehow have classes about that so they know that other children were.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, you know, not, I mean, this expectation that Christians are always supposed to be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, Christians are always supposed to be joyful. You know, don't be sad. Don't be down. You know, Christians, you know, if you really trusted in the promises or whatever, you wouldn't have those kinds of emotions. And that is just not true.
Or if you had more faith.
If you had more faith. If you had more faith.
Mm-hmm.
And sadness and despair and, you know, or really those kinds of sorrow are one set of emotions. Anger is another one. Mm-hmm. You know, the rage of Stuart. You know, Stuart was a boy enraged. Mm-hmm. And he had no place to let that out. You know, rage is another emotion that devours people who've known abuse. I mean, just to have that burning inside and to have Christians say, Christians aren't supposed to be angry or to discourage anger. What do you do with that as a child of an abuse? You know, for you to be able to grow as a person of faith, you need to access that anger and that rage or that sorrow and despair. But if it's unfaithful to do that, you're feeling like you're always something wrong with you. It's really a very something that communities need to reflect on. How many times we subtly discourage people being sad or angry or real emotions and what that must feel like to somebody.
I wonder if the growth of, you know, the psychotherapy, the idea of people running to a psychologist and running to see their therapist and so forth, is that a barometer of failure of the church? I don't know.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Finding in the therapist what you're not finding
in your spiritual life.
Yeah.
I think it's a sign of strength when a minister can send somebody to a therapist.
Right, yeah, that's definitely.
So maybe it's not in opposition, but, you know, if we can draw on the resources.
I'm trying to think of ways to gear a barometer for society so that we can, you know, like abuse children. GNP is the best in the world and we have the most abused children. GNP is the best in the world and we have the most addicts. GNP is the best in the world and this litany of things. Uh-huh. And I mean, how do we say that we have a reasonable society when all these ills are here? And we look at an underdeveloped country, they have none of those ills.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I see both things happening. I mean, I certainly see people finding in therapists what they do not find in church. I mean, acceptance and people to talk to and deal with real painful things, that kind of thing. I think a lot of people do experience in therapy a healing relationship that they don't experience in faith communities. Mm-hmm. But I also think there's an appropriateness to that. I mean, that therapists are trained and specialized in some things that the faith community can be supports and allies in. But a pastor, you know, who's gone to seminary has no business doing deep psychotherapy with somebody struggling with abuse issues or incest issues. You know, I mean, they do need to be referred to somebody who, but to continue being an ally and certainly be part of that. But we do need the psychotherapists.
Professional. Our families have, you know, gone in all directions. Also, I mean, how many of us are so lucky as to live where our parents live? Or, you know, it seems like the splitting up, if you will, of the family unit has a lot to do with that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you would naturally turn to family members for some of those things.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
My theory is that the grandma is a person who accepts you exactly as you are and you have no faults. And so I think that's
the role of the grandma.
I read just a beautiful one the other day. To be a perfect parent, find out exactly what your child wants to do and then encourage them to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rather than getting them to do what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm. What person is budding in this child? Mm-hmm. And how can I nurture that into being? Yeah, I think that's really great.
Well, it seems like there isn't the forum in the organized church for parents or groups that are in some sort of difficulty to get together and find out that they're not all that unique.
Right.
That there's company to their misery.
Mm-hmm. And these struggles
are okay.
Right, and that is, and right, yeah, and struggling through these issues are okay.
Yeah,
yeah, to feel embarrassed when your child's in worship and you know, not knowing what to do with that is a very common parental feeling. And there are other parents who feel the same
way. You stop going.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, having support groups or forums where parents can get together, I think that's really a tremendous, tremendous idea.
Well, I know this is just anecdotal again, but I think that there's more awareness now. But I know this was a long time ago, maybe, you know, 25 years ago. I have a friend who whose scoutmaster made advances and, you know, was sexually active with this young boy as a young teen. And finally, when he told his mother that he didn't want to go on a trip with her, you know, his mother became very, very frightened, turned to the pastor, and the pastor made him get down his knees and ask for forgiveness. But I think we've come farther than that.
I hope so.
In some places, we certainly have. Uh-huh. But in some places, we haven't, you know.
Yeah. Well, we haven't. We are very active enablers as a church community sometimes for things that, because we don't want to get involved. you know, just ignore it, look the other way, and it's, and so if you're going to look the other way, well, I certainly am, you know, I don't want to stick my neck out here. So I think that's, on the other side of that, there is a need and an active display of that need in the growing churches, which don't happen to be the major denominations, but the churches that are growing the fastest, it seems to me, are the ones who make a covenant with the people that join. Oh, you can't just sign up. You've got to sign and agree to, you agree to tithe, you agree to take part in the body, you agree to go to Bible study, you agree to, I mean, it's not easy to become a member of a really growing, active church. Mm-hmm. And it may be too entirely easy to join the Episcopal Church or the Catholic Church or the Lutheran Church or whatever mm-hmm. denomination. And so we're not like your mm-hmm. catechism.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly like that. Right. But what I would love to see as part of that kind of a training is for parishes to be very intentional about doing child abuse education, you know, sex education with the kids. I mean, where else in the context should sex education be done about what the dignity of the body is and how God creates the body, and in the course of that, you know, what is good touch and bad touch, and what do you do, and if somebody ever does something to you, and educate. I think all volunteers in the church, any volunteer that works with kids, should, as part of their volunteer training, be educated about what kinds of symptoms suggest that somebody's been abused, and what would you do if somebody ever approached you, and what are the different types of abuse, and how do they give rise to different things? I mean, that just ought to be common, you know, practice for training of volunteers.
In the Boy Scouts of America, now, in reference, I guess, to that, all of their training information, and in fact, in the front of their Cub Scout handbooks, there's a tear-out section that deals specifically with that.
Good for them. Good for them.
They're very aware of that.
That's great. That's why I think there's
yeah, definitely.
Most of society, there's a growing awareness of the problem. You don't want it to be hushed up. And right. In the Episcopal Church, if you're going to work with children, you have to take a course.
You know, how do we get, a lot of us get our esteem from our paycheck? I mean, it's very Skinnerian. You peck and you get the pellet. You peck, you get the pellet. And you do this all your life.
That's right.
But when we look at children, what's the economic value of children? I mean, in more agrarian societies, they are valued mm-hmm. more heavily. But it seems to me the place of the church is to give value to children, that they're valued for their innocence and the love that they give. And because in the outside world, the system we live under does not matter from an economic perspective. And I think that a lot of times transfers into parenting. I mean, what's the value of my child in relation to some new product that I can purchase?
So in that sense, it's countercultural.
It's very
to
countercultural.
Celebrate and value children for just the uniqueness that they are, right. And not
in
because
the
they produce
culture.
Anything in the economic market culture.
My niece, who just said right. that she just has a baby who's 8 weeks old and she's gone back to work full time, and I said, "Well, gee, couldn't you take a little bit more time off?" Well, we've become very accustomed to our lifestyle, and your heart just kind of breaks into
right.
thing.
You know, but I've seen interesting cases too, where they had the wife of a cousin who was pregnant, and we were talking, well, what are you gonna do when the baby comes? Well, I'll go back to work, whatever. Da 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 da. It's just like, wow. She had no concept, and she never went back.
This particular niece did.
You don't realize. Yeah, I mean, sometimes people come, they don't realize what it all entails.
They're giving up. Right. I know. Mm-hmm. That's happened with our daughters-in-law. We have two daughters-in-law. Mm-hmm. Had every intention of going back to work, and they're still off it, which I think is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And fulfillment is work. Mm-hmm. Work sets us free. I mean, we're not there yet, but I mean, that's our system has that kind of.
Did anybody ever die and say, I wish I would have spent more time at my work?
Right. No.
Well, maybe somebody who's in the poorhouse.
So, well, thank you for a generative conversation. And
what were some of your other questions that you have for us?
Well, actually, there's quite a few.
You just got to one.
Well, just to name some, what is hospitality? Hospitality to our children as a community of faith, which we did talk about. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be hospitable to perpetrators, though, who are part of our communities? And what does it mean to love them and embrace them with justice, with a hard line of justice? But to them and to the children, but also with compassion, and that's a very severe difficulty that people wrestle with. The other big one is forgiveness. What is forgiveness in the context of this? Pardon me?
It's everything.
Yeah, and so many people who've known abuse struggle with, I just don't feel like forgiving, I'm so angry. Mm-hmm. And they don't want, my father or my mother or whomever, they won't acknowledge what it was, you know. I mean, they say I'm making it up, and I know I'm not, you know. So how do I forgive somebody who's not even acknowledging something? And, and forgiveness is a process that takes time to wrestle with your anger and all of that. And yet if we just have these Christian communities that we only say you're supposed to forgive everybody and you won't be forgiving unless you forgive, there's like this weight, you know, that there's something wrong with me because I don't feel forgiving, and that agony about that. I mean, the whole practice of what it means to forgive is very different.
You pretend to forgive, mm-hmm. and you don't deal with what you really are thinking about, because mm-hmm. you have to make
that's right. So you pretend and then you repress all of that, or you forgive and forget, you know, and say, well, I'm supposed to treat my, you know, father as if it never happened, and so bring my kids over to this house, and you know, whatever. I mean, you know, what is forgiveness? What does it mean to forgive, and what's the relationship between forgiveness and reconciliation, and what needs to happen before reconciliation can happen? I think it's a very complicated thing that issues come up from the perspective of abused.
You know, we had a wonderful confirmation or affirmation from one of our kids. We took our kids practically everywhere, and it was at a time when nobody did. I mean, you didn't take your kids on vacation, you didn't take your kids out to dinner, you didn't take your kids anywhere, you left them with a babysitter, and we always took ours. And one time they asked the kids, and we traveled a lot too, because Tom's a United pilot, and so we traveled all over. And I asked them one time what difference it made in their lives that we took them everywhere, and got a lot of answers. But the one answer that really meant an awful lot to me was the one, our second son, who said, you know, you took us everywhere, and nobody else ever took their children anywhere. And he said, you know, we knew you liked us.
That's a very interesting comment.
Wonderful.
That's my wife had the same comment. Her father would go off on vacations. He was a scout leader, and that's all the vacation was him going. You know, and she was never included. Mm-hmm. I think she feels excluded because of that.
Not liked, maybe.
In that context, I think it's true.
That's right.
Just a hospitality.
Exactly. Exactly. Well,
you can feel, or the youngsters can feel, not liked by the community because of this acceptance thing and confirmation to a specific way of doing things. And that's just not my way, so therefore I'm worthless. I don't buy into that. So, exactly. And it's a very, that teenage time where this feeling of worthlessness can be magnified very easily, mm-hmm. Outside the church and even inside the church. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that that needs an awful lot of prayer and perhaps mm-hmm. revision in our community.
Yeah, celebrating youth in the church would be different because we our society celebrates youth, but for all the wrong reasons.
Right, that's right, that's right.
You know, I want to be young again.
Afraid of dying.
Yeah. Never go back. I should never go back.
I think being a grandma is the greatest.
That's right. That's right. So. Well, so those are, I mean, I think that we certainly have scratched away at practicing our faith. It takes on varied shapes when we reflect on it from the voices and lives of these persons. May their voices and spirits remain with us as we continue to practice. Amen.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, well, that was really generous.
What time shall we eat?
That's right. That's right.